Hi, folks, and thanks for listening to this Echo Chamber podcast. A couple of quick things before we kick off. The podcast you're about to listen to was recorded a few weeks ago with our good friend and regular contributor, Shamim Malakmian. Shamim, as long-time listeners will be well aware, is the best journalist on the immigration beat and was covering the 10th city around the I-Pass offices around Mount Street long before it became a cause de celeb for certain politicians and indeed certain journalists who seem to think that they discovered something that Shamim was covering for over a year. Anyway, it was great to sit down and chat with Shamim. Make sure you check out her work at the Dublin Inquirer. We also have a bit of a scoop ourselves on the Tortoise Shack. Former 2FM broadcaster Keith Walsh just got a decision against RTE that he was not a self-employed contractor. He was indeed an employee. And that decision could have ramifications for over 300 people who were let go by RTE following the Eversheds process. The details of that podcast are available right now exclusively for our members at patreon.com/tortoiseshack. So if you're not yet a member, please join us. It's the price of a cheap pint nowadays, but it helps us continue to do the work and have the conversations like the one you're about to listen to and like the one we had with Keith himself. So one more time, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. I am shutting up now. Enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and folks, we kind of all sat and watched, and Martin, you remember the horror we watched of tents yet again, the images of tents along the streets of Dublin. Not only were they along the streets of Dublin, but the government then made a decision, made a call to pick them up and dump them into dump trucks. And, you know, they had them plucked out of the sky and dumped down. I had that awful feeling, if you recall, not so long ago, the Owen Murphy situation whereby his poster was up in the background when they picked up a man who was still in the tent as it was disposed of, and he suffered life-altering injuries. I had that kind of grim realization that this is, you know, human detritus, Martin. Is that a fair phrase?
We've discussed this. They've put a bottom rung on the ladder, is what they've done in Irish society. We've now put another bottom rung on the ladder. There's somebody to look down on for everybody. And it's actually really disturbing me that people that are looking down, people who've been looked down on all of their lives, are now looking down on refugees and migrants living in tents. And it's like, this time last year, or this time 2 years ago, it was you being looked down upon. And now you're doing it. And it's like, oh my God, will you cop yourselves on? But what the government have done, Tony, is just par for the course on what they've done on housing all along and on homelessness all along. These are not the first tents we've seen in Dublin.
No, they're not. They're not. And we've seen them. I've been seeing them for years as I'm going out for a run and the rest. But when you're sitting there and you're watching how it's devolved, I want to focus primarily then, Martin, on just one last point. I know people are probably sick of me saying it, but tone does come from the top. You've gone from abolished direct provision to at least they're not all in tents to, well, the tents are better than the streets, to dump those fucking tents. So that's what we've had. And that's been the political journey of this particular coalition government. We are delighted to be joined back on the podcast by the best reporter on the immigration beat in the country, Shamim Malakmian. And she now works for the Galway Inquirer, Shamim, I believe. Is that what, I saw you in Galway. What's that all about? How dare you? How are you doing? It's good to see you.
Yeah, no, it was good to see you too. Yeah, it was just a conference about like gender-based violence and representation in the media.
Yeah,
it was over for that.
I think you've been doing great work, not just as a reporter, but I've also, you know, seen that you've been going into sitting, contributing to panels and sitting in on these talks, and it's really good to see, and that really does matter. But just remember, like, we discovered you first, like, you know. It's no, pal, look, I do want to talk about that situation over the Patrick's weekend, because you wrote the definitive report on it and you put up the most poignant image that evening when you joined some of the men for iftar as they broke their feast on Ramadan. Can you tell us a little bit about how that situation evolved a year after you've been writing about the tents that were springing up along Mount Street?
Unfortunately, it's very similar to what happened last year. I think it's a bit worse, and but the vulnerability and the exposure that the men, I saw the men always being exposed to, it's always there. And I think this year this year it got more media attention, I think. And because it got more media attention, everybody keeps writing about it and writing about it. And I think there was an article even about, as we celebrate St. Patrick's Day, this is what's happening in their town, city, or whatever they call it. And so I think that there was lots of pressure on the government to do something about it. And so what happened, we saw with the relocation of people. And it was quite sudden, because I was to meet the stores outside the IPO as usual as they were sitting there. But what happened, that I got texted that they were all moved to Crookslink. It is very similar. It's very similar, I say. But I've said this to you before, they are both very exposed to both far-right violence and people who are well-meaning, but they're endangering their lives in different ways. And that's sad to see, I guess, yeah.
But you,
their lives are, I get what you're saying. When you're making a focus of this group, regardless of which side you're coming from, you're making a focus of a group.
I'm sure if you read the article I did on it, there was mention of when I was there, before they were moved, they were talking about how, their tents were sprayed with political slogans without their consent, and they didn't know, they couldn't read
things like that said, like, we will win, this is unjust, all like statements that they clearly didn't do themselves.
Yeah, and so there was things like, I think there was one about green racism, something like that, and I just knew that the asylum seekers hadn't written that. And they actually, as soon as I just looked at one of the slogans, they started pointing it out to me that they hadn't written it, yeah.
But isn't that kind of the problem, Shamim, is that because they've geared it this way, the government has, that it's far more visible to the ordinary person than it should necessarily be. If we had adequate housing numbers, we wouldn't see people on the streets. But the fact that we are seeing them on the streets is bringing it into sharp focus.
Yeah, of course. If they weren't so vulnerable, nobody, members of the public couldn't be so close to them. And like, they can't, essentially, people who live in those tents, essentially, it's their place of residence, you know. But when I was there, some of the guys came back from Crookslink, like, it was full of reporters, activists, and locals, and people some of them just wanted to go and have some rest. And some of them were absolutely upset about people taking their photographs, for example. They told me that they just want it for the social media. They just want to come here and take their photos. And it's not a good feeling. Just imagine yourself being there, people constantly coming to your place of residence and taking photos.
It kind of doesn't matter whether it was a politician making a video or it's Pavan Gepper, gobshot. They're all coming in on your privacy, on, as you said, your place of residence, and it's all, they've all got an agenda that is not essentially going to aid those individuals' cases in such a way. But I again, one of the things that you pointed out is that for many of the men, you were able to speak to them in their language, and that mattered. So does that bring a certain level of that you have to be almost more cognizant of their feelings as well, because you can see them, you can meet them where they are and speak to them in their language?
I like to think it makes them more comfortable with me, I like to think it makes them more comfortable and makes them tell stuff to me that they might feel like somebody else wouldn't understand them the way I would understand them. I think it's important, to be honest, I think it's important to be able to connect with the sources on some level. Even if you just tell them that you're Middle Eastern, that you can immediately see the reaction they give to you is completely different than the reaction they would to an Irish. Actually, one of the first questions they always ask me, they're like, "You're not Irish, right?" And when I say it, yeah, and they really like that, I think.
Isn't that kind of shocking though, Shamim? That the reception they've gotten here is so bad that our perception of ourselves as a welcoming people, and everybody likes to talk to the Irish and the Irish are great chatters, it's not actually true.
I don't think they necessarily don't want to talk to Irish people. I think they might there is a sense of familiarity, maybe, that they think I would kind of have with them in some ways that maybe the Irish people wouldn't have. Absolutely. I think it's important for reporters to kind of familiarize themselves with the culture and with the language if they're covering immigration, for sure.
Oh, yeah, I know. Do you know the crime correspondent, Mick O'Toole? I think he's got 4 or 5 languages now. He's almost speaking fluent Arabic. I know he's got Italian. I know he's got French. I know he's got, he doesn't do great English, but you know, that's just because he's a crime correspondent. And if Mick, if you're listening, I don't care. So yes, I said it. But he finds that it actually, even he's constantly shocked by the lack of Arabic speakers, for example, in our services, service providers. And it leaves those individuals who are at a disadvantage. And we had, you know, you've spoken to people who came here specifically to Martin's Point because they heard Ireland was a welcoming place. They've made that kind of, well, maybe it didn't come specifically. That's probably a big overstatement. But they came with the impression that Ireland was a welcoming place. They really got a rude awakening, and it's really like disturbing to think that we've gone to the situation whereby you went up to Crookslane. What did you see?
So as soon as I got there, I saw it. At first, I couldn't understand what was going on because my source was saying he was sending this text, voice memos in Arabic, and he was saying the guards wouldn't let me come out because there are gangs out there. And in my head, I was thinking of like literal criminals. So I couldn't understand what was going on. But as soon as I got there, I saw the tricolor.
Some of them were literal criminals, Shameen, but that's a different story.
So it's a far right protest. And when I was there during the whole time, they would constantly be harassed. As soon as they would get out of the gates, there was a young child, and this boy could be 16 or 17, and he had this huge camera. And he would just jump in front of the asylum seekers who would come out of the gate and start taking their photographs like paparazzi, like there's some sort of, you know, celebrity in it, and just saying the nastiest kind of abusive things to them, that the adults would, you know. And then he would take the photograph, and then he would get closer and closer to the gates and take photos also of the men inside the gates. And as you saw, some of them they've hidden their faces. And at one point, I think there was a mixture of more organized people who had balaclavas. They were very more like openly abusive to people. And then there were some people who were just might have been just locals. And then there was at one point they started falling out with each other. They were just yelling at each other. And that's also not like people, that's just being a nuisance, you know. And at one point they had like 4 cars, and they had taken up all the bus space for the bus to pull over. The guys were clearly like they had their head down, and they were walking in front of them. And it must be so intimidating to just walk like in front of people who want to be.
It's incitement. They're looking for a reaction.
Yeah, of course. And I think everybody, all of the asylum seekers, were quite aware of that. So they just did not say anything to them, you know.
There's an element, and I don't like this phrase, but I'm going to use it. There's an element of human zoo to this. We saw with a couple of years ago when there were so many Irish people homeless on the side of the street. And, you know, in a subliminal message, the message is don't be homeless, you know, pay your rent, whatever the rent is. But is there a subliminal message coming from government, do you think, Shamim, with this, that is don't come here?
As I talked to somebody from an organization in the UK, he was saying to me that it can be part of a deterrent, like wider deterrent European policies, just kind of discouraging people from coming to Ireland. But the problem is research really shows that people who, before they move here, they don't necessarily know what it's like for asylum seekers here. They might come and they see it and they might leave. To go on to another country, but it doesn't mean that they wouldn't come in the first place. But then again, when asylum seekers in these situations leave the one country, they're always being really judged really harshly and being labeled as asylum shoppers, when they do leave another country. But then the government some governments push them to leave. They want them to leave. And when they leave, they are being labeled as trying to shop for asylum, you know?
First of all, thank you for your continued coverage. I think it's the best as, around, as I say all the time. And that story will be something that should actually haunt us as a country, you know, that what we saw happening, and whether you want to believe they did it just to get rid of people on St. Patrick's weekend or whatever, I don't really care. It happened. That's what happened, and that's how it was done. The last point on it I want to ask you though was, what was your experience when the guys managed to walk the couple of hours back, and you met with them and you had a chat? How was everybody's mood there, apart from exhausted?
Everyone absolutely was exhausted, but I think there was a feeling of kind of like anger, you know, a lot of people were angry there. And, I feel like, there was a bit of also confusion, in the air because they didn't see it coming because it was so sudden on the morning of the Saturday morning. So the guys were just, I think, befuddled. A lot of them just standing there befuddled. And then some of them around were trying to push up new tents. I know Dara from People for Profit told me that they brought some new tents for them so they can set it up. But I think they're very bit comforted. The fact that they could get away and come back to a place that they were familiar with. Some of them seemed to come and kind of like, okay, we're back, we're there and it's better. And to be honest with you, like, I get messages from them sometimes saying, looking for like beds to rent, essentially. But it's Dublin, like it's really hard to find anywhere. Yeah.
Sorry.
But we did see a news story about a facility with quite a number of beds available, Shamim. Is there anything about that?
Which facility was that?
There's a facility, was it 160 beds available in the facility, Tony? I'm sorry, I can't remember exactly where it is. It's in Dublin. There's a facility with up to 160 beds available, and for some reason it's not being made available.
My understanding is that from just looking at departmental reports, my understanding that is the accommodation providers can make a decision whether or not they would want single male international protection applicants in their premises or not. And some of them, because they know there's so much hassle attached to it, some people just don't want them. And like some of them were worried that they'd be subjected to arson attacks. And so like, I think the department was said in their statement to me that, oh, we thought the Kirtland site was state owned. So there was no kind of complications like that.
But that aside, you mean the actual industry, the misery industry of asylum seekers now. I mean, you've written a story now about East Wall and what's happened there. And we've watched some of the, you know, the protests where it sprung up in East Wall and how it became, you know, a touch point for some of the ugliest scenes that we've seen and how it's evolved from there. Do you want to share some of the insights in terms of the story that you published a couple of days ago now? And what's actually happening with some of the individuals who are there in these who are being paid to be there in these situations?
So I got I heard of the cases of people working in East Wall Centre and how basically there were some form of there's a power imbalance, I think, in all of the asylum centres, because there's the managers and then the residents. And the managers also have a lot of power in terms of, because they can get people transferred, you know, they can just say to IPAS they're making trouble. So there is a power imbalance there. But what I had heard was that, there were some inappropriate relationships happening between managers on site last year in East Wall Centre and some of the residents, some of the female residents. So I put in a freedom of information request, and sure enough, it showed that this was the case. And we found that the company involved was called Fuel. It's an event management company. But unfortunately, because they didn't respond to my queries, but what I understood was that they They said they launched an investigation after Eastwell for All, which is a community group, raised this concern with the Department of Children. And so there is an investigation, and the two guys involved were in probation as well. They hadn't passed a promotion, probation. And then one of them was apparently let go for unrelated reasons. And one of them, resigned. Yeah, one of them resigned and one of them was let go for unrelated reasons. And then they said, we are happy. The residents were happy that the matter resolved. So this concluded. But yeah, so this story, and then we realized that the company involved was an events management company. And I just couldn't get the responses from Fuel to understand what was their thinking of going into an asylum shelter, to run an asylum shelter. It would have been much better if they would kind of talk to me and tell me what they thought. Maybe they had a good reason to be there. I don't know.
That's simply unbelievable story, Shamil, isn't it?
Yeah, it's
well, Martin, can I just say we had a events company getting a contract for ventilators in Ireland during COVID, if you recall.
No, but as always, where there is a power imbalance, Shamim, and where there is a power imbalance, you have abuse. I mean, as always, this is nothing new to us.
Yeah, of course. And then the problem is that some people, actually just today I was talking to people from another center, and they were telling me that when they complain to IPAS against the manager, sometimes IPAS just forwards it to the manager, and the manager comes in, shows them, and they're like, why did you write against me? You know, and it's just a very...
The whole whistleblower system works that way. I can tell you that for a fact, Shamim.
Shamim, I've one last point that I'd like to raise with you, that you mentioned, and Martin outlined it, but there's an ugly phrase they use, these create push factors. You know, it means push back. You don't want to come because this is how bad it is. It's essentially, and I hate to say this, it's essentially giving credence to the Ireland is Full mob. It's giving credence to that. But outside of that, Ireland is now talking about entering into the agreement with the EU in terms of the more restrictions on freedom of movement for people. And we to this point, we haven't done that. And we're not overrun with asylum seekers or migrants. We've had a huge influx following Putin's illegal invasion of Ukraine. But does it worry you to see that these push factors now, as they are, that's what it is. It's pushing people back to say, don't go there, you're not welcome. Does it worry you to see them becoming policy?
Yeah, because as you said, like it's very political, you know, and it has a political usefulness when people talk about when Leo Varadkar, I think he said that, I am saying to everybody who's traveling through Europe but thinking of coming to Ireland, to this is a situation, you cannot get accommodation. I think he's communicating this to a lot of voters, you know, potential voters who might like that kind of message. What kind of actually amazes me is that when you talked about the migration pact, I think Ireland's housing crisis was quite outlined why Ireland argued as something because they couldn't take people. But it's kind of interesting to me that they didn't raise the same argument about the war in Ukraine. And they could have taken a limited number because it wasn't like Ukrainian refugees couldn't travel across Europe, you know. I'm very confused by why that was not argued. And that makes it even more political in my eyes personally, you know.
Well, I mean, we were given the answer, Shamim. They were Christians, they were white, and they looked like us. And we were told that. So, I mean, take the answer we were given, that's why. So there is an element of racism in this. Certainly is. I think we have to counter too, Tony, that, you know, every time we say Ireland is full, we're giving credence to an argument that doesn't bear
out. I agree.
Ireland is not full.
Full of empty homes.
And it's either derelict or it's let out in short-term lets, you know. So Ireland is not full, not by any chance. I mean, there's enough to house everybody a couple of times over. Ireland is imbalanced. Ireland is unfair. but it's certainly not full. And I think we need to stress that every single time we say Ireland's full, we need to fact check ourselves, let's say.
But thanks for that, Martin. But I also want to point out that in the last few hours, Fine Gael Councillor Michael Doyle and Fianna Fáil Councillor Andrew McGuinness in Kilkenny have basically jumped the hedge, as you would imagine, and said, oh, we're hearing rumours of... We're writing to Roger O'Gorman to express our deep concern and disappointment regarding the lack of consultation with local communities and the elected members of Kilkenny County Council in relation to the accommodation of IPAS. Here we go again.
But that can be true too. And let's just say that. That can be true too. So let's balance this out. The government's very, very bad at informing people what's happening. It's really, really bad, which is creating part of this.
But Martin,
Martin,
they are the government. That's Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael councillors doing that.
I get it. And there's it's hypocritical that they do it, but there should be better information and there should be buy-in from communities. If you do this properly, there's buy-in from communities. What we're getting is people getting this happening under cover of darkness. That's not good. The optics are not good. At all, Shamim, what's your feeling? Because you have a better idea of this than we do.
I think the communications that comes from the government, it shouldn't be like from emails only and things like that. I think somebody should go there and talk to people and locals. And I think they should not be prejudiced in terms of class. You know, they should talk to people as if they respect them and they understand them and they're all the same. I think most reasonable people would kind of accept that.
Yeah, when we break down the figures for last year, I broke it down, it was like one family per parish in Ireland last year. That was the figures, and that was the highest year on record. Now, every parish can absorb one family. Every parish can. You know, it's not a big ask. It's just the way it's being sold to people. It's being sold in a very bad way to people.
Narratives are terrible, Shamim. The narratives are unvetted males, fighting age, blah, 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 as opposed to some of the situations where we've seen integration occur and seen a revitalization of some communities and people actually saying how it is a great thing in certain areas. So, I mean, there's parts of Ireland, as Martin said, that are absolutely entirely derelict. That's what they are. And we need to understand that, like, outside of some of the frozen tundras of the Nordics, we're the least densely populated country, you know? Come on, guys, let's wake up to this and let's be honest about it. But thank you, Shamim, again, for all the work you do. I know I appreciate it. Martin sometimes does. He doesn't show it very often.
You know I do, Shamim. And, you know, I think it's a very lonely beach you're walking out there. And I think it is. And I think what you do is very brave.
Thanks so much.
Brilliant. And make sure, lads, make sure you support her work, please. And keep on sharing the stories and reading the stories and listen to people who are telling you what is really happening on the ground. You don't need someone fella walking around with a camera phone looking for likes and clicks. That's not where the work is done. Thanks again, Shamim. We really appreciate it. We will talk to you all very, very soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.